What's going on, everyone? This is my interview with Siobhan from Spells of Genesis. Doesn't really need an introduction, but for all of you who don't know, Spells of Genesis are one of the most important historic projects in the entire NFT space, built on Bitcoin back in the olden days of, 2015? Siobhan and I get into kind of the history of Spells of Genesis, how he started it, how his company kind of morphed from a trading card company into an online blockchain company, and just how that's led to its current place in the pantheon, I guess you'd say, of NFT projects from a historical perspective. So really, really good stuff. We get into the burning mechanics, which a lot of it, people are interested right now as far as Spells of Genesis. Are they going to burn a bit? Siobhan talks about that. So that's going to be interesting to all you Spells of Genesis fans. But enjoy my podcast right now with Siobhan from Spells of Genesis. All right, man, we got a lot to get into. There's a lot of interest in what you guys built over these years. And I mean, obviously you're feeling it, I'm sure. What's this all been like for you the last 6 months, building something, you know, on Bitcoin so long ago and all this renewed interest? What's that been like for you?
Very interesting, very busy. So the thing is, when we designed the cards, Spells of Genesis cards 5-6 years ago, the idea was to represent allegorically blockchain history, because we were sure that blockchain will change the world. And at some point in the future, people will go back and see how it all started. So we wanted to put that history in the image, in the imagery, because we wanted to be in museum in 50 years. And so all this craze suddenly came quick. We didn't expect to have that on a short period span. We always thought it will take value over time, but not as crazy as it has been this previous month.
It's so funny you said 50 years, right? Right? It's so funny, right? You didn't know the people were going to start digging it up. I mean, obviously, you guys never went away, but, you know, this massive renewed interest, or not even renewed, just a massive interest in what you were doing. Tell me how it kind of all started for you. I know you had other games as well, but tell me how you kind of got into the whole space. NFT and blockchain space, how that all happened for you?
So in 2015 and before 12-13, I got interested in Bitcoin. I saw some articles, and it was all about the price. So some article was saying, oh, the Bitcoin went from $50 to $100 dollar value, and I thought, oh, I should have bought this. And then I forgot, and then suddenly a new article saying, oh, Bitcoin went from 100 to 200, that's crazy. And I thought, yeah, this time I need to buy some. And then I bought some, and it was very complicated at that time. Today is still complicated, but at that time it was even worse. Yep. And then the more I learned about it, once I got my Bitcoin, the more fascinated I got. I thought, this is really a game changer. This is a one thing that happens in a lifetime. I would say so. There was already internet that changed a lot. On how we work, how we do things. And when I dig in blockchain, Bitcoin, I thought, this is really the future. And at that time, there was very few projects. The community was small. Ethereum was not even there. And people were looking at crypto as a freedom, financial freedom, decentralization. And it was a lot about monetary, the fact that you can pay or do a thing with cryptocurrency. And I really thought, okay, blockchain offer properties that are very interesting for many, many different fields, not only just for payments, but for a lot of different things. And having this scarcity and transparency, I thought we could emulate that for different fields. So for our field of predilection game, we thought we can offer ownership of what people purchase using blockchain technology, Bitcoin technology. And there was some work on colored coin and the fact that you could create coin on the coin for Bitcoin. And I thought, okay, we could use, instead of having a coin that has for payment, it could be something that represents an asset, an item, a game that has the same property, transparency, auditability, non-duplicability. Mm-hmm. And that's how really all this got started. I really want to apply this massive innovation into our field, which was gaming.
So what were you doing with gaming kind of before Spells of Genesis?
So before Spells of Genesis, we produced and released a game called Munga, a trading card game. So inside the game, there were possibility to trade cards, digital cards, for in-game currency. And player did that. They were happy with it. And we quickly noticed that some cards have high value when people were paying real money under the table and made in-game transaction with game currency. And then right. came back to support and saying, hey, I'm hacked, I'm this and that, can you revert and everything? And this was a big topic and still a big topic is what happened when players own something of value inside of a game and they sell it for real money. Yeah. So it is not allowed it was not allowed by our term and policy and also on Munga, but on many other game, it's the same because then you're a bank. If the card has value, you're a bank because you hold the database data and you have full power over it. And if they have value, then you hold this value for the users.
Oh, wow. So you were looking at it like you, from a regulatory standpoint, you were worried that you might get in trouble if that kind of thing happened for you. Is that the way you were looking at it?
Yes, but it was not really about getting in trouble. It was more like convenience for user. And we don't want to have people on the support asking for reverting a transaction, for example. Sure. And they use real money over PayPal and everything, and we don't have a view on that. So we cannot say, yeah, you paid him or you are the right owner because you paid it for that money.
So you were looking at it more just like a business, from a business standpoint, you didn't want to get into this whole like hornet's nest of issues that are going to arise by people coming to you with complaints about losing stuff or getting stuff ripped off or all that sort of thing.
Yes. We cannot be in the middle of their trade. Yeah. They're trading their real money because we don't have the tool. Right. But we believed, and that's more also a core belief. We believe that physical things are very interesting because when you go to a shop, you really own what you purchase. You can go home and use it and share it to your friends. And even if you don't play the game, for example, I hold some Magic the Gathering cards myself that I played when I was much younger. I don't play anymore, at least on physical one-to-one, but I still hold them, even though they don't have any gameplay value for me. They still have history value for me. And mm-hmm. we really wanted to emulate that, this fact that you can own and offer that to our user. So the problem, I would say, arising was a natural problem that happens to everybody, but we really wanted to add something new or bring a new aspect that would have value for for end users and myself that I would enjoy to really own something. Even when the game is closed and out, you still own the assets.
Yeah. How did you actually get into like gaming as a career? Because I think this is interesting. Like for my, I'm just thinking of my kid, right? He loves gaming. He wants to get into gaming. How did that actually happen for you personally?
So since I'm a young kid, I always like to do my own games, like writing my own rules and things like that. I got into programming because I wanted to be able to make a reality of my ideas. So I learned programming when I was a school boy. And at some point, I decided to create Munga. That was 2004, around that. So I was before my university studies. I took a year off and I full-time worked on Munga, which is a trading card game. And among all the idea, game designs idea I had, Munga was a card game, and it was interesting for three reasons. One is the doability. It was something that I could do by myself without the need of 3D programming and like a one-person project it could fit. Second is the ability to expand the universe. So when you do a trading card game, you can easily produce new cards that extend the whole story, the whole universe. So you can continuously produce content and having a living story and a living world. That's the second point. And the third point, it's easy to monetize compared to other genre. You can produce new cards and put them on sale, and they sell quite good, usually, cards. So it has all the ingredients for a project that I could handle and I could do by myself. So I launched that before my university studies as a fun project. And then after my university studies, it was the beginning of the smartphone, and I decided to make it professional and have the game on iOS.
Wow. Did you build that did you learn how to program on iOS yourself, or you had somebody help you build that?
I build on iOS myself. The first iteration of the game was built by myself.
It's super cool. Like when I interviewed Christian, and you know, he built Saratobi, but he built, you know, other stuff for other people too, because it was kind of like his job. And he was like, oh, I guess I better learn how to build on iOS. You know, and just, you know, it's like out of necessity, you learn how to build. It's so cool. How was it received when you released it on the App Store?
It was very early. So we got some very early success, I would say, as it was the one of the first free-to-play game. So at the time, there was no in-app purchases. So there was five versions of the same game, so same code and everything. There was just a different variable that will unlock a certain cards in your account. So there was a free app, a $1 app, $5 app, $10 app.
Oh,
and
wow.
If you buy them all and open it, it will fill your account with all the possible cards.
Oh, cool.
So it was not in-app purchase, but it was free to play. So you could download the free version, but you could also buy a more expensive version that will enhance your gameplay. But in the end, it's the same app. So that was before the in-app purchase. So it was well received as it was a completely free app, when other games and product, usually they had only a demo for free, and then you had to pay for the real version.
What year was that? That was like what, 2011. 2011.
2010, 2011.
the old iPhone, the tiny one. Yeah, that was like iPhone 2 or something. What iPhone was that one? I can't even remember back then. The little one.
it's iPhone 3G. During my university studies, I studied mobile development because I was quite a fan of what we could do in mobile, and that was the Nokias and the old style mobile. Yep. And then came the iPhone with more capability and everything, and I thought that would be a great business. And at that time there was no business around mobile apps, so nobody never paid for any app on their Nokia phones or whatsoever. So the App Store was really a new ground, and it was very exciting at that time because it was like pioneering this new tech.
Wow. So then you moved, and what made you create? I mean, obviously you were creating Spells of Genesis because you saw this idea of being able to use blockchain as kind of the mechanism for people to trade themselves and to you know, buy, sell without this kind of middleman or you standing in the middle. Was that like the impetus, or you were like, no, it's time for a new game and let me just do the game on the blockchain, and that, you know, where the cards live on the blockchain? What was your like thought process to the creation of it?
One thing was doing a new game. I wanted, because the Munga was 5 years old and game usually have life cycles. So I wanted a new game, but I also wanted that the two games use the same assets. So connect doing Spells of Genesis with the ability to use your cards, blockchain cards that come from Munga to Spells of Genesis. So, and also it was to illustrate that with blockchain, you could have two use of the same item. That's like in the multiverse that we're doing now. So the motivation was to do a new game with all the knowledge that we have from 5 years of experience of doing games. So having something new, but also keeping the previous game open and being able to play the same character on those games.
So your idea was to take the cards from the initial game you built and have them somehow available on Spells of Genesis? That I didn't understand that was...
Yes, the idea was to create new cards, blockchain cards, that are at the same time playable in Munga, the old game,
and in
Spells of Genesis, the new game. Okay. So the company objective was to create a new product and using blockchain to have like a bridge between the two games.
I got you. So how when you first released it, how many cards were there? And what were you thinking about? This is one thing that's kind of come up, this idea of supply. What were you thinking when you first created the cards and the way you, just walk me through how you were thinking about supply, because I think a lot of people right now, everybody's like, oh, one of one and this sort of thing. And it's like, I want to go back in time and grab your brain, what you were thinking at that time about supply of the cards when you were actually creating Spells of Genesis.
Yes, that's a very big, important topic. So supply, it was kind of hard to know what's the correct supply when there is an empty ground, nothing alike. There is a question of the size of the community, the actual community. So there was several people. Maybe 5,000, 10,000, I would say, really active crypto enthusiasts in the world who are using some different project or kind of our target audience. We looked a bit on the very early trading card game supply, like Magic the Gathering, and the number of prints that they have. And the question of how many was always a big topic. We had to choose. We thought the max supply for our card, the first batch, the one that are created in 2015, will be 2,000. And the lowest will be 200 of the same print. And why not one to one? So we thought about it. We thought, do we release unique cards? Problem is, in a game, if you release something on the one unit, first, it's a lot of work for one unit, but that's fine if the price is okay. But it creates also frustration, because people want to play with that character. And if there is only one, very few people will have experience on that. Yeah. So we, along the roads, we thought a lot, do we release some unique items? And we thought that's not for a game, thinking of a game design, game community, it's not a good idea. It's a good idea when it's an artistic thing or mm-hmm. or for different use cases. But sure. for a game that you want people to play, having a single unit is refraining a lot of people from enjoying a bit of the experience that has been tailored.
Yeah, I think it all, like you just pointed out, creates a point of frustration rather than enjoyment, right? For gameplay. If you see a one of one out there, and obviously that, you know, maybe the person who owns it's never going to get rid of it, you're frustrated. You create a frustration point rather than an enjoyment point. That's interesting.
So our rarest card is 200, and I think 200 is a good number, because if you really want it, and if the community grow, it's possible for you to have it. But it will be very expensive, but it's still possible that we'll still get at least one seller that will get rid of it. But on one-to-one, you might not.
Let's talk a little bit about this, because and kind of bring it into the modern day, this idea of supply. Because recently, Shapeshift burnt a whole bunch of the Shapeshift card, right? Which is very interesting. And I'd like your kind of view on that, just from as the game's developer. And then also get in a little bit to your view of, do you think this is good for, you know, how would you, if you were talking to Shapeshift and they were like, well, we want to do a burn to kind of create more value for these cards, create more scarcity, what would you like recommend for them? What would be a way you would kind of frame the thought process for how many to burn to make sense for the marketplace? Like how would you think about that?
Yes, this is a hot topic right now in the community, the burning. So for Shapeshift, I really like this card because of his historical impact. And I actually talked with Eric Forhees from Shapeshift, and I suggested him to burn a part of it, because for them, it has an interest, because they are a big holder of the card and their business model is not selling cards. So it will create some spark of interest around the brand, and having for them a card that is very uncommon, very rare, is a very good move for them to burn. So I would, if a partner, someone hold a big number of a certain card, doing so is a very good thing, because they will push also the value of their card brand, so it will get more visibility. So this is a very good move. People in our community, they are asking us a lot to burn our own supply of cards mm-hmm. that we still hold. And for that, it's not something we want to do, because the cards, the supply of 2,000 for the max cards that we have, will eventually get absorbed by the market. So burning today, for example, half or to own only 50, has a positive impact for the very short term. So yes, the card, the unique price of the card will grow, but for a very short term. And this will work for 1, 2, 3, but after the fourth card, the impact will be lower and lower. So it will be a big thing for the first one. But overall, we're losing value. And as
you're losing value as the majority holder of the cards, basically, is what you're saying, though. Right.
Yes. Yes. Right. And also for the market fluidity, 2,000 is not a big number for the one that we have a lot, and we're betting on long term. So it's also it's also a short term vision to burn them out and to sure. increase value. We might make more money today with the rest that we have. But long term, 2,000 is not a lot. So in 5 years, the card price will go even higher. And then if we burn the supply, so the difference between, let's say we burn 200, the difference between 200 and 400 in terms of total people who are willing to get the card will be very small. Right. So the price change will be quite, let's say if the card worth 1 million a unit, and if we burn, maybe it will worth 1,100,000. So the difference will be very small. While we will not be able to sell card in the future, where it's our strategy to be here long term and to sustain value over time, because you never know how things evolve in 5 years. And of course, if we had done that, for example, 5 years ago, when there was not so much demand, we could have burned the card just to artificially boost the demand short term. Then we wouldn't have some cards to sell today, and we wouldn't have been able then to finance the development of the future version of Spells of Genesis because of a bad decision we took 5 years ago. So it's really about thinking on the long term, where the supply, I think, makes sense.
Yep. This. Well, as you said at the start, it's a 50-year plan, right? Not a 5-year plan. I know. I mean, I do understand it from, like, I get it. You know, people DM me all the time about this sort of stuff, and you know, and for them, it's about, well, burning rewards the early adopters, right? In a way. And so I get that, but I also understand your perspective as the business owner, right? And somebody who actually wants to grow a larger community of Spells of Genesis fans and collectors, right? Like we said with the one of one, it's hard to have collectors when you only have one, right? It's hard to have a large community when you're restricting and restricting and restricting supply. So it's interesting. It is interesting what Shapeshift did for theirs. So you felt, because for them, they had a very large supply, were the largest holders of that card, you thought, and they're not in the business of selling cards, this was the quickest or the easiest way for them to increase the value of those cards, where they could do a minimum number of transactions to basically provide liquidity to whatever the DAO or whatever they were funding with those cards. Was that the kind of idea? Was that, hey, they no longer have to have whatever it was, 1,000 of these cards, they can now have, you know, 30 of them or 40 of them, with a much higher value, that if they want to sell those in the future, they don't need to sell 30 rather than 1,000. Was that,
yes,
roughly getting it there, understanding?
Yes, the for them, they position their cards, Shapeshift cards, as the most rare by burning. So it has value because it increases the eyeballs on Shapeshift. Gotcha. If, for example, we burn half of all our supply of all the card, it doesn't increase the eyeballs on a single card, because they've all been balanced at the same level. But yep. by burning Shapeshift, they really push it as a legendary, at the legendary stage, on top of others that have a higher supply. So it, yep. it pushes it at the rank of a Satoshi card or one of the most important cards. So from their brand perspective, I think it's a very good move, because then they put the card in the pantheon of the best card of the game.
Right, as the top of the most desirable. Very interesting from a marketing standpoint. And then from a collectability standpoint too, really interesting. One question that came up, this is, you know, Discord's back and forth, and from a, it doesn't really matter so much from a collector perspective. Oh, I guess it does, because it's this idea of like firsts and this sort of thing. And so I got it into it a little bit with Christian about Sarutobi, and ooh, did I lose you?
I cut the video because, oh yes, now it's there. It was frozen.
Okay. So I got into it with Christian from Sarutobi about this idea that a lot of people are talking about right now, which is play to earn, where obviously he built Sarutobi, and by playing the game, you know, if you played it enough, you won tips in Bitcoin. Did Spells of Genesis have any sort of play to earn mechanism in it when it was first launched?
Yes. So there's two major steps for play to earn. So one of the way to earn by playing is the leaderboards, where you earn blockchain token instead of in-game stuff, and this has real value, real trade value that you can do, and that's a very big added value. I would say at that time in 2015. And then there was a big feature that we developed and released, I think 2017, which is blockchainization. So the idea of blockchainization is you play the game, you get the card, and you level up to the max level, and you receive a blockchain copy of the card. So it goes out of the database, game database, and becomes a real blockchain token that you can trade. So if you are a committed player, you can blockchainize cards along the way, receive a blockchain copy, and then sell it on the market. So you could
wait. So that was in earn. That was in Manga, or that was in Spells of Genesis?
That was in Spells of Genesis. In 2017, I think it was released, the feature, blockchainization.
Blockchain is it? So wait, I'm not understanding though, because the card's already on the blockchain, right? So how is it? So you were, what is that? How did that mechanism work? I'm not, explain it to me again like I'm five.
Yeah. Let me explain you. So there is, the game is a free-to-play game.
Right.
So with free-to-play game, you need cards to play for free.
Okay. Gotcha.
So when you register your accounts, you get some card for free. And this model is required to be on the stores, Apple Store, Google. People gotcha. Need to be able to play for free without the need to connect to blockchain. So gotcha, you can gotcha. Play without any blockchain cards, and you gotcha. Receive some in-game cards. Within all our cards, we have a Siri, which is our blockchain native. So those cards you cannot get in-game. You can only get on-chain from buying them from the market, the blockchain market. Mm-hmm. So there is the in-game cards and there is the blockchain cards. In-game gotcha, cards gotcha. Free to play, you can earn by playing. Then when you level up max level an in-game card, you can convert it to a blockchain card. And then this leaves the game and goes to the blockchain. Very and cool. the supply of those is, of course, unlimited because a player will can play and blockchainize over time, but will limit the number of blockchainization. But as player play, new card enter the market, and those are blockchainized cards, and they're a slightly bit better than blockchain native in terms of power, if you look at legendary. as it gives some incentive for people who are really committed to play rather than collectors. Mm-hmm. So they can sell the card on the market and player will buy them as well from player who actually blockchainized.
Gotcha. And tell me about the leaderboards, because the leaderboard, so that was 2017 that you put that in. Tell me about the leaderboard. When did you start doing that? And what were the kind of mechanics of that?
I don't want to be wrong, but I think the leaderboard is there from day one. Mm-hmm. So first launch of the game, 2016, it was the beta version. So we always had a leaderboard in the game with reward on the leaderboard. I don't remember exactly what were the price for the leaderboard, but I'm pretty sure we always had blockchain item, the one who are limited, that are offered to people who are on top of the leaderboard. Mm-hmm. Each month, each year, we schedule a leaderboard with we look at our card supply and we take cards from our supply and we put on the leaderboard, and it's usually planned 1 year ahead. Each month you have
So at the end of each month you'd have like a winner, whoever was the top on the leaderboard, or was it the top one or the top like top 10 or something, each got a card.
It's not only top one, so there is tiers. So the first one gets a very rare limited card usually. The other flowing 2 to 5, they're getting another a card that is a bit less rare but still cool. In 5 to 10, there is some other. So it's not only the first one.
Very cool. That's cool. And something more to dig into. You know, it gets crazy in what I'm in, the NFT archaeology space, because people will be like, well, that's not play to earn. That's like a competition. And I'm like, well, you know, I mean, words are, it sounds like play to earn to me, but it's, you know, it's not like you do that, you play and then you automatically earn. It's a leaderboard. It's a you have the opportunity to win, but that's kind of what it is. I mean, you know, I'm just giving you pre-warning about some stuff, people hitting you in DMs with the back and forth as to who's the first or whatever. Frankly, I don't care necessarily who was the first. All I care about was that you were building awesome stuff way back then, which is incredible. I can't even imagine. Were you bootstrapping most of this, like just yourself, or you had a small team working with you? How many people were working with you back then?
Let me come back to something you just said. Sure. So yes, leaderboard is challenge, but it's still earn. But the feature that is not challenge is the blockchainization. So blockchainization, you receive your card on blockchain and you can sell them and you don't have to be on any leaderboard. So you can blockchainize.
Oh, that's 100% play to earn. Yeah, no, that's 100% play to earn. Yeah, yeah. There's zero question on that one. Zero question. It's just a little bit later. That's the only, you know, it's 2017
That came later.
Yeah, no, that's 100%. Look, man, there's zero questions that you and what you built and Spells of Genesis was absolutely pioneering. I mean, just off the chain, pioneering incredible stuff. Zero questions about that. This is all just the nitty gritty stuff that I think people are going to write books about, you know, in the future. And so these kind of details are the things that are going to be chapters and books and stuff. So the 50 years you were talking about, you know, museums has been compressed to like, you know, 8 years, which is probably much, much quicker than you anticipated, you know? actually, I'm just thinking about it. Are you guys, the Sotheby's auction, are Spells part of that? Are you guys part of the Sotheby's auction that's happening this week?
No, not this time. We're discussing with Christie's, and also we'll do Sotheby's later on if it doesn't work. But yep, we are working on that side, which is one big thing on our on our list.
That'd be really fun, and funding your Discords and stuff to have people your fans and collectors hype that stuff up, which is fun. I mean, right? It's like what happened to you, where, like you were saying, you thought in 50 years this might be great, that people can kind of see the history of the blockchain and it might end up in museums. And here you are, you know, whatever, 8 years out or 7 years out or whatever, and here it is, man. Did you ever think that that would happen?
Not so fast. Not so fast. It happened very fast. I think we are a bit in a bubble period. We saw it a lot in crypto. Yeah. So a lot of interest in a short period, then it goes a bit down, and then it takes some time, and then interest is renewed. So on the linear scale, it will, the interest, the value will grow over time. We say 50 years, but 5 years from here, the card will be even more valuable. But there might be some up and down in terms of interest. That's the difference between, I would say, pop music or something very popular for a short period, and something really legendary that stays over time. So pop culture, they have a big success in a very short period, and then a year after, everybody has forgotten. Yeah. We are trying to aim for the legend, like the, not the pop star, but the rock star, the Elvis Presley of NFTs. So over time, it will get value. Mm-hmm. Just like CryptoKitties, for example, CryptoKitty was super popular at the time when they were released. CryptoPunk was unpopular and completely overtaken by CryptoKitties. But then now people remember punks, and they're more valuable because they really pioneered something. CryptoKitties as well, but... sure. It is more a fashion something. CryptoKitties is more something of a fashion. CryptoPunk is more history.
Yeah. Yep. I love that idea and that strategy. And I'm with you 100%. I think it's the way when I talk to, you know, founders and developers who've built kind of these old projects, I tell them, get ready, because what's going to happen in the Discord when we relaunch is everybody's going to be like, when are you going to start marketing? When is this going to moon? When is this going to, you know, when Lambo, right? And I tell them, get ready, because that's the way it's going to be. But what you need to start doing is thinking exactly like you're thinking, which is now, this is a 50-year plan, not a 5-month plan. And what we need to do is build this community and build awareness over time. And there's no shortcuts to doing that. You have to educate people. You have to love what you're doing and grow it, you know, organically over time. And I think, you know, it's kind of been put on the fast track for you now, which has got to be just amazing and probably a bit life-changing. But I know you're working on other stuff too, like Crystal Sweets and stuff. Tell me about that and how you got into that. Were you just not busy enough? You just wanted more stuff to layer on top? Or what made you start kind of that arm of your business?
The thing is, after the 2017 bubble pop, the crypto winter, how we call it, we had to reduce the team for Spells of Genesis, as many projects. So many projects died. We were not in a very good shape, but we focused and we started to say, okay, this is a long long run, and crypto is not dead. Everything is not dead. Even the Fed was passed. We have to build something for when people will start to understand how blockchain changed things, how NFTs are important in the game industry, and we decided to build tools. So when the big names like Ubisoft, Electronic Arts, and other will come and say, hey, we also want a blockchain, we have something, a tool that we can value. So we wanted to build the ground foundation. We're building the ground foundation for when this will all explode. Mm-hmm. So we worked on the multi-chain approach. So we at that time, everybody was betting on Ethereum and Ethereum only in terms of tokens. And we thought we are not just moving to Ethereum and just move the game all to Ethereum. We said, okay, people will use Ethereum, but they will also use other chain token because using a specific blockchain is a choice. It's a governance choice. It's not just a technological choice. And people say, oh, this is superior. This is cheaper than Ethereum. This is faster. This is better than Bitcoin. So it's not only a choice of technology, but it's a choice of governance. And there will be space for a lot of different views and belief. And we want to build something that allows people to hold their token in the chain they want and have a unified experience. So this is what we built over time, and we integrated that in Spells of Genesis. So right now you can hold your card in three different chains and more to come. So this is very important, and I think this will shape the future as well, NFTs. So you will hold token and collectible on many different places, right, and you will need some unified interface experience to access all these tokens.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that I've talked about a number of times now is this idea of, you know, Bitcoin is really, really clunky to buy and sell NFTs for the average user, and I'm just talking about me. And one of the things that Ethereum's really good at, I think, is just this, the idea of it's much more difficult to screw up than on Bitcoin. So I interviewed like the founder of Emblem Vault and what they're doing, being able to take your Bitcoin asset and bring it over to Ethereum. And I think we're moving to this like this multi-chain, as he put it. If I'm looking at the internet, I don't care if it's what's running on the background. I just want to be on the internet. And in the future, this idea of like, I don't care what, you know, blockchain I'm on. I just want to be able to move my assets around and stuff. So that's your kind of view of it as well, and what you're trying to build as well?
Yes, exactly. So just for Ethereum, it is not simpler, definitely not, but it has more tools that makes the whole experience simpler. But in the base layer, Ethereum is much more complex to handle than Counterparty, which is sure, simpler. But it's the ecosystem around that is very mature and very popular, and there is a lot built on Ethereum that makes it more accessible, like OpenSea, for example.
Yeah.
This will change. Counterparty now, they funded JDOG to be full-time, so there will be updates and feature. So over time, it will get simpler as tools evolve. But also the choosing of Ethereum or Counterparty in that case, it's also a choice of beliefs, core beliefs. So some people say Ethereum is centralized, or the decision maker are there and we want something more decentralized. And this viewpoint make people decide not to use one or this chain. And I see it's like different countries. So when you do a collectible and NFT on Ethereum, it's like you're making your product for the US market. Right. US market is big, there is a lot of stuff. And then if you do it for Counterparty, you're doing for Portugal, for example, smaller, but maybe there is less product, less competition there. And each of those countries have their own governance, core belief, heroes, or whatever. And people sure opt in, contrary to the country where you have to obey to the rule. Then you opt in because you like this vision, you like Vitalik's vision, you like someone else EOS, or you want to be in Binance, it's cheaper, but it's controlled by one entity.
Right.
So all these choices, it's not only technology, it's not because it's simpler or because it's faster or cheaper. It's also because I like this kind of governance. I like the fact that this person is paid when I do a transaction, or this the miners and who receive what. So, but there is a place for many different technologies, and we want to address a tool of internationalization. So when you make a product as an artist, you say, okay, I want to sell it in Russia and the US and France and Spain, for example, regardless mm-hmm. of the interior markets regulation and structure.
Yep. Can you, your video froze there for a sec. Can you maybe pause, do what you did before your video froze for me. I don't know if it's, there we go. Yep, yep, back. One thing that this is an issue, and it's the reason I haven't recommended people buying on Bitcoin, buying Spells of Genesis or Pepe's or any of them really, was this idea of the dispensers. And tell me if there's a better way that I'm unaware of that, you tell me that if there's a better way. This is my understanding of the situation. If I want to buy a Spells of Genesis card and it's in a dispenser, right? If I send the money to that dispenser, send the Bitcoin to that dispenser, and somebody else's Bitcoin gets there first, I not only don't get the card, I lose my Bitcoin. Have I got that wrong?
I don't know much about the edge case of dispenser, but that's a question that I ask myself, and I don't know. I'm not expert enough in dispensers to know exactly what happens. What I notice is that as soon as you sign a transaction on exchange, the dispenser detects it and then is telling you that you shouldn't send your money. But it seems like yes, and I don't know when this edge case happened. From my experience using it, as soon as I paid, the dispenser was closed. But there is a risk here, but this needs to be asked to the more expert than me. So yes, dispenser a bit risky, but maybe somebody will say the contrary. I'll be happy to hear it.
No, people have told me like that's the risk, and that's the reason I don't, you know, recommend it. And that's why I was excited when Emblem Vault started, you know, figured this out in a way that could get everything on kind of Ethereum, because Ethereum takes away that risk. And yes, it's clunky in that, you know, you're basically have, I don't even know what you call it, a wrapper or a vault holding the Bitcoin asset, you know, rather than you interfacing directly with the Bitcoin asset. But for the average user who, like myself, is not technical enough to understand this, and not aware enough to understand the risks, is the real thing. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
The thing is, on Counterparty, there is Counterparty DEX, which works very well, but that has no risk. But the problem is there is no easy to use interface. And it's all about making an interface, and we are Counterparty today lacks a bit of interfaces, because otherwise it works very well and you have no risk and you have a market. We used to have Book of Forbes, which is a wallet that has a simple interface for DEX exchange. But I think now what Counterparty needs is more user-friendly tools, and this is something we want to work on for the future release.
So when Spells of Genesis 2 coming out on Ethereum? I'm joking. have you thought about it? Did that ever cross your mind?
So simple, everything we'll do and we do will be multi-chain. And also one thing on the game that I was thinking in my mind that I did during my free time, is to make competition. So to have a Ethereum team, a counterparty team, a EOS team, Binance team, whatever, and compete for your favorite chain. So if any new game, Spells of Genesis 2, a completely new game, we will always use our tools that allows people to hold their token in their favorite chain and have a unified experience when they buy, when they sell, regardless of the chain. So it's completely transparent. And so that's what we aim to go. So yep. Doing an Ethereum game, yes, but not only.
I love it, man. Hey, thank you so much for joining me, man. I really, really appreciate it. It was great to chat with you and chat about Spells of Genesis, which is so historically important from my perspective as an NFT archaeologist. I mean, it is like in the pantheon at the highest level. And so I really, really appreciate you taking the time with me today.
Yeah, thanks a lot for the invitation.